You're listening to the Plugged In podcast presented by the Institute for Energy Research. To find out more about our work, visit theinstituteforenergyresearch.org.
Welcome back to the Plugged In podcast. I'm your host, Alex Stevens, and today I have a little bit of a different episode for you guys. Gathered some of the best people from around the free market think tank world who are working on energy issues, and we're going to discuss the current state of energy policy here in the U.S., and each of us has brought a topic that we want to discuss with the group. So let's jump in, and I'll introduce my guests. Joining us from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is Paige Leiberbant. Paige is a research fellow at CEI in the Center for Energy and the Environment. In her role, she covers the electrical grid, energy regulation, nuclear power issues, and other free market energy topics. Paige, welcome.
Hi, Alex. Happy to be here.
And from the Manhattan Institute is Mr. Jordan McGillis. Jordan is City Journal's economics editor. Previous to that, Jordan was a Manhattan Institute Paulson policy analyst. His research and writing on energy, technology, and economic progress have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and New York Post. He writes regularly for National Review and the American Spectator, has been cited by the U.S. House Committee on Ways and Means, the Congressional Research Service, and the U.S. Defense Department's Journal of Indo-Pacific Affairs. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Alex. Thank you for reading every word of that bio that I wrote for myself.
And last but not least from the Cato Institute is Travis Fisher. Travis is the Director of Energy and Environmental Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He has nearly 20 years of experience in energy policy, including leadership roles at FERC, the Institute for Energy Research, the Department of Energy, the Electricity Consumers Resource Council, and the Heritage Foundation. Travis, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a mouthful. Are we going to talk about the common thread here? Institute for Energy Research employees,
all of us? We're all IER alums, and all of you guys have been on the show in the past.
Still waiting for my alumni sweatshirt.
Well, my thinking for the show was, you know, working with you guys, I've learned so much from each of you, and trying to emulate just sort of like the discussions that we had when we worked together, and we still have when we run into each other at events and stuff around town. So I guess just to kick things off, you know, I kind of want to chat about just like the current state of U.S. energy policy, where things stand right now. And in my mind, I kind of came up with like three practical issues that, I don't know, I think we sort of face, and wanted to get you guys to sort of react to that. So the first is just sort of a practical problem, which is right now there's a huge growing demand for energy and electricity, obviously. Data centers, AI, crypto, Jordan's written quite a bit about this, Travis yourself as well. And our ability to build out new generation and transmission is being blocked by regulations through the permitting process. And how we deal with all this, you know, is probably the central energy problem of the next decade, I think, for policymakers. And then the other two issues that I kind of had are, I guess, like a little bit more philosophical in that I think there's been an enormous shift in the mindset in the U.S. where innovation and progress is often being seen as being driven through government rather than through markets. And, you know, in the energy space, I think that's like probably the most pronounced area. So I think the challenge for us there is to make the case that a lot of times the proposals and stuff that we see coming from Washington are often sound very forward thinking and trying to drive innovation and stuff, but actually, in the long run, a lot of that stuff leads to stagnation and less progress that we want to see on those fronts. And then the final thing I would bring up is just with respect to energy policy, I think there's a glaring lack of respect for sort of the concept of consumer sovereignty in this space. You know, I think policymakers have really overstepped in terms of their attempts to sort of constrain the choices that people are making in terms of sort of products they want to buy, the appliances we want to use, how we use them, the cars we want to drive, where we get our energy from, and that stuff. So, Travis, I guess you're sort of the elder statesman in this group. I'm sure there's things that I've missed in those three things, but you know, your reaction and just your thoughts on sort of the current state of things.
You had to call me out for being the old guy. I get it. That's actually, I'm excited to be part of this group because it makes me feel young again. I think the main thing that you highlighted, this is something that I'm focused on a lot, is this idea that we are going to struggle to meet growing demand. And so we basically had this pause in overall power demand in the US. Somewhere in the early 2000s, it started to basically level off. And we reached this little flat period. And we just thought that that was always going to be the case, just like we thought that growth would be the case for the century before that. And something weird happened. We started finding new ways to use electricity. It basically overwhelmed all of the, some folks would call them gains. I'm not sure I would put that positive a spin on it, but we had a very energy efficient approach for a long time. The whole idea was like, we just need to be more efficient. We're not going to use incandescent bulbs anymore. Once we shift over to LEDs, then we don't need that much power. Well, you know, we had some fundamental changes. A lot of computing power. That's sort of been the game changer, whether that's for AI or Bitcoin mining or all of that stuff. So now it's an open question. We know the demand is coming. How are we going to meet it? We have all sorts of EPA regs. The power plant rule is coming, not just on the supply side. It's actually, we're forcing more on the demand side too. So if you want to force people to change from, let's say they drive a gasoline powered car, if you want to force them to buy an EV and plug that in, then all these open questions about how we're going to meet this demand. I think a lot of people had this idea that we would just build a ton of transmission and wind and solar and that would fix it. Finding out that's very hard too. Not just the siting of the wind and solar, but the transmission lines themselves, and all that takes so much time. So it's a very slow moving thing. And so we're basically on, I view it as like a collision course with reality where we really want to use electricity. And it's going to be weird. This is like, it's a very un-American thing to say, well, you have to wait. You have to get in line. You can't use the power that you want. I think people are going to get fed up with that. So I'm very curious to see how it works out. I don't see it working out well. I see a lot of infighting, but that's the thing that I would key on. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Travis, I've got a question to follow up with there regarding the electric vehicles. We know, and we're hearing a lot in our circles about the challenges of new transmission siting, as you said. What about at the distribution level, getting that power to the 15 garages on my block that are supposed to have an electric vehicle in them in 10 years? How is that going to work? What are the challenges in different parts of the country?
So it is a challenge because I don't think the existing equipment, just like the hardware, isn't made for it. It's the, you know, your neighborhood is not wired for that type of juice. So what you would need is probably new transformers.
That is a real concern
that there isn't enough wiring to get that the volume of power to the end user.
So usually it's just a question of it's going to take time and money. The really interesting thing here is there's also energy efficiency rules on transformers themselves. And so there's a DOE rule that's going to tighten that. That's another thing where, like, if we're already in a supply crunch where we need the hardware to come in and we're not really making this stuff here, and I don't see that as a fundamental problem, but there's been sort of a supply chain that's like everybody points out there's supply chain issues. What they're really talking about is it's hard to go out and buy a transformer. If you wanted to upgrade your neighborhood wires, you can't just go out and buy a transformer. It's not like it's on the shelf at Home Depot. So that is a legitimate concern. And it's also, it's complicated by policy too. So at every stage, there's the what ought to happen, which is just building the stuff that you need. And then there's the obstacles, which is usually there's an agency that comes in and says, this is why you can't do it. So there's that flavor of things at every stage.
I think you get into something really important there with the DOE transformer rule, because it really shows the preference for sort of small efficiency gains rather than large productivity gains. The DOE transformer rule, if it went into effect and was able to be achieved, would only save about 1% efficiency on electricity transmission. It's such small potatoes for what it would require, which is a fundamental redesign of all of the transformers we use, the metal that is included in them, and how they are produced. And so that difference to achieve this 1% efficiency, you're going to fundamentally remake the entirety of how we produce transformers, I think is a symptom of the broader regulatory idea that, like, anything should be done in the name of efficiency gains rather than just finding a simpler, easier, faster, better way to make a whole bunch more power really fast so that it stops mattering as much.
Only thing I'll add to that, because turns out I agree with everybody here. The layer that I think makes this make sense is if we're not sure about the relative cost and benefits of tighter standards, I mean, that's what cost benefit tests are for. I think a lot of the stuff that we're doing now won't pass a cost benefit test, unless, of course, you inflate the alleged benefits and use things like a wildly inflated social cost of carbon, et cetera. But the fundamental thing is we're at a point now where always cleaner or always more efficient at all costs, that even if it ever made sense, which I don't think it ever did, but we're at a point now where the marginal gains, you know, the marginal benefit of a tighter standard is tiny and the marginal cost is getting higher and higher. And so we have to realize where we are, and that idea of always more efficient, always cleaner, always, you know, that sort of at all cost mentality, I think that has to go.
I agree entirely.
Certainly diminishing returns. Jordan, my understanding, so just going back to your thing on the build up for EVs and stuff, my understanding is the thing that would really explode those costs are the ideas about like the two-way charging, where you plug your EV in your home to charge it, obviously, but then it can also be used as a battery, basically, to feed back to the grid. Rewiring homes for that, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but that, try to get homes to a place where they can feed electricity back to the grid, is what really like explodes the costs there.
And tied in with it, of course, are the labor requirements
and our seeming lack of skilled technicians to meet this demand that's coming their way. Big problem in California, where I live, of course, where these labor markets are tightly regulated. And there's a kind of question of, are there enough people that have the aptitude and willingness to do it? And then also, are we stopping people that maybe could do it from getting the jobs because of our regulations and licensing requirements?
Yeah, so I mean, people who say energy is sort of a narrow focus, when it, at the end of the day, sort of all of the issues that people in the free market world talk about, really, when you're trying to build out big infrastructure projects, all the things that we, you know, we're concerned about, licensing things like you mentioned, all that stuff sort of comes into focus. The consumer sovereignty thing, Travis, I know you're working on a piece about utilities coming into conflict with consumers in terms of what they're using electricity for, and it's a big political fight over that. You want to talk about that just a little bit?
Yeah, I'll sum it up by saying, keep your stinking paws off my electricity. The whole idea about like, well, what are you going to use it for? I think the idea that there's good versus bad energy use is, it would be hilarious if it weren't such a policy problem. Actually, I think it's deadly serious. So the example that I've seen most often is, you go on X, I hate to call it that, you go on former Twitter, now X, and you hear people use phrases like parasitic load, and they're talking about Bitcoin mining. It's because the thing that they either don't like, maybe they actively hate it, maybe they don't understand it. Either way, it doesn't matter. The person is buying electricity, paying for it, and using it for whatever the heck they want to use it for. Like, this is America. I can use electricity for whatever I want. But you're seeing this growing movement that like, well, hang on, what are you going to use the electricity to do? Are you going to mine Bitcoin with it? Are you going to use it for AI? Is it a good use or is it a bad use? Is it pure or is it parasitic? And that sort of adding a moral layer to energy use, of course, that's always been the case in terms of like, you know, the climate questions and if you're using GHG emitting fuels versus not. We're talking about the same electricity. This is the same grid supplying the same electricity. And now one type of electricity use is inherently bad and the other one is inherently good. So if you're using like if you're using electricity to split water into hydrogen, oxygen, the green hydrogen electrolysis process, of course, that's got to be good use of electricity, right? That's a positive thing. If you're using it to mine Bitcoin, that's bad. This idea that you could split hairs and say this use is good and that use is bad, that's, I see that as fundamentally flawed. And if anybody listening disagrees with me, let's put that shoe on the other foot. Let's say, I don't know, Trump is president and he declares that you can't use the grid anymore if your whole idea is to use like an EV supercharger. That's going to be a big load. It's basically like converting a gas station to this giant power plug. So if Trump comes in and says, well, I personally just hate EVs, that's parasitic load in my mind, then we get into this weird political battle over like who gets to use electricity and who doesn't. That I'm seeing the beginnings of that, and that worries the crap out of me.
Well, it's worse than weird. It's
it truly is getting at a fundamental moral political question about how decisions around the physical resources of the world get made. Is it going to be the price system that is the moderating factor, or political consensus? You could think of other conflicts that could arise in human history. If someone wants to use stone for making beautiful sculptures, and their community says, no, we need that stone to build more houses or more temples, that's a fundamental values conflict, and that's what's coming to play here. And I think that the free society moderates these things through the price system. As you said, if you're willing to pay for it, you cover the costs and internalize them, you do what you want with those resources that you bought.
Yeah, I think that this whole thing is a great argument toward allowing price signals to determine these sorts of things, not our value judgments. But I think that the slippery slope here, from like it being, you know, grid scale things like Bitcoin mining, to it being a personal control thing, especially as smart thermostats come into play, smart grid connections come into play, that it could become, okay, no one can run their oven at a certain temperature for too long, or, you know, you can't take a shower at like longer than this period of time. There's no
personally,
reason you would want to set your...
I cannot sleep with the temperatures above 64 degrees. I'm sorry.
Neither can I. That was where I was getting next is, you know, your thermostat's locked to 69 degrees in the summer and 62 degrees in the winter. And that's as hot or as cold as you can get, because that's what we as a collective society have decided you're allowed to have, rather than, okay, you know, even though I live in, you know, Florida and it's 90 degrees out, if I want my house to be 68 or 9 degrees, I'm allowed to make it 68 or 9 degrees as long as I'm willing to pay the difference there. I think that that's an important distinction to allow people to make, to, you know, we as human beings have discovered really cool ways to control our built environment and to sort of willingly squander those in favor of allowing, you know, different political things to control what people are allowed to do instead
this
of-
This is also why I'm in favor of Wendy's
surge pricing. Let me pay as much as I need to pay to get my Frosty.
It's exactly though. It's, you should be able to pay to internalize the cost of what you want to do. So, you know, if you want to keep your house too cold, if you want to keep your house too hot, if you want to be able to, you know, cook something elaborate and take hours to do it instead of cooking something quick that would objectively use less energy, because, you know, the meaningfulness of a big family Thanksgiving meal is more important to you than, the same thing microwave version. I think that those are meaningful distinctions we should be allowed to draw for ourselves. And that
I wrote a piece at Discourse a year or two back on
this with specific respect to the Bitcoin question. And in hindsight, maybe this is a waste of resources, but let's just allow the market to process that decision making.
Yeah, I think also the optimal amount of waste isn't none. I think that one of the biggest ways that we as a society figure out what's good or what's not good, or what technology will work, what technology won't work, what is the future, is by letting really smart, interesting, weird people who want to try weird stuff do it, and do it in an environment where they have some freedom to mess up, some freedom to waste something. You know, maybe someone's going to try to like make something new and they're going to waste a whole bunch of resources to do it, but one in every 10 times that thing ends up being like the technology of the future and is great, and the other 9 times it amounts to nothing. I think that we should form a society that gives people the freedom to make those decisions and sometimes waste things and not have anything come of it. But I think it's worth the try. I think it's worth it to be attempting to innovate rather than allowing ourselves to stagnate.
I'm going to go with a yes and here. So
love it.
Yes, Paige is exactly right. And the idea of knowing what's wasteful and what's not, that requires experimentation. So there's no way to know a priori whether a use is going to be wasteful or not. And in fact, waste is in the eye of the beholder. There's sort of the Spooner approach, where like vices are not crimes. What's a vice to you might not be a vice to me. And it's a matter of degree and all of that. We can apply that to the electricity sector too, by thinking, well, what seems wasteful to me, let's say I don't like it as cold as Jordan does. I would probably set it at more like 69, 70. Jordan setting it at 64, that is wasteful to me. We need to put a stop to it. That's a very subjective thing. To Jordan, it's inherently useful, and that's a valuable thing for him to use his power on. For me, I would set it at 69. So, but waste itself is in the eye of the beholder. So this idea that we have, and here's an example. This is where the rubber hits the road, I suppose. the Biden team has already proposed, this is about a year ago, and it's still showing up in their budgets. They proposed this DAME tax, digital asset mining energy tax. So they are trying to put an excise tax on cryptocurrency mining. So they're basically saying, we don't view it as valuable. We view this as wasteful. So we're going to tax it. Or either tax it out of existence. There's a utility in British Columbia that basically says, we're not going to allow crypto mining on our system anymore. This was, I don't know, about 2 years ago, and I think it was upheld by the courts. So it's not just a philosophical issue. It is that, but it's also showing up in rules, and it's showing up in your everyday life. And even the Wendy's joke, Jordan, that's not even a joke. Wendy's uses electricity too. If every electricity use is affected with the public interest, which is what we hear over and over again, like, what's the public interest in Bitcoin mining? What's the public interest in fast food? The free market answer is, what do you care? I'm going to use it for whatever I want. But this idea that because electricity is affected with the public interest, then all of a sudden every use has to be viewed through a public interest lens. That is the exact wrong way to view it. Everything is subjective. Everything is a personal use. So I'm very bothered by this whole thing. And even the Wendy's joke, man, I'm sorry, Jordan. I can't even let you joke about Wendy's Frosties.
Interesting too. So like at the level of politics, I guess it's interesting how these questions of, economic freedom, it's often coded, I guess, in sort of like right-wing language of freedom and liberty and stuff. But to my mind, it's kind of like a left-wing thing, right? Where like your ability to move around the country and experience new cultures and do, you know, meet new people and do new things and stuff, like this should be something that people on the left care about, I think, right? And, you know, especially if you get down the level of like, you know, how higher energy costs and things, you know, impact the poor and all this sort of stuff. So I don't know, at the level of politics, it's just sort of interesting that, you know, restricting people's usage of energy, which is basically going to restrict their ability to do anything, right? How that places constraints on people, you know, to experience new cultural products, all these things. So,
well, and it's demoralizing too. It's usually from like either an explicitly religious point of view. So like you have the folks coming from the right saying you shouldn't be, I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of data centers that their whole job is basically like explicit material that somebody from the right wing wouldn't want you to be viewing. Like, but that's how people choose to use that power. And then, you know, it's the same thing on the left, not explicit religion per se, but this idea that like you should always be using less and less. Like that is it's a value judgment that is coming from one group and they're trying to impose it on someone else. So it is sort of like the old school, like the classical liberal point of view that used to be more in line with, I suppose, what the left used to be, which is this like individual freedom point of view. The unfortunate part is I'm not sure either party is really buying into that. So instead of saying we value individual freedom, it's the right doing their own moralizing, the left doing theirs. Of course, they don't see eye to eye, but they're both moralizing and trying to impose that on you.
So I only have you guys for a limited amount of time. So why don't we jump into our topics? Because I want to get through some of the things that you guys brought, because you have some interesting articles. Paige, why don't we start with your piece that you brought about the Indian Point nuclear power plant. I believe it was in The Guardian, right?
Yeah. So I've been covering the closure of the Indian Point nuclear power plant for several years now, since when the first unit closed in 2020. And at the time, I consistently wrote about the fact that it would probably raise prices and that it would probably end up raising carbon emissions rather than lowering them, as many of the environmental groups who were proponents of the closure and actually were the ones suing to kind of make the closure happen had claimed. They had claimed that it would, you know, result in somehow like equal or fewer carbon emissions. And recent EPA data just does not bear that out at all. According to like the recent EPA data, it's been so much more carbon intensive, the New York grid, since the closure of these two units than it had been before. And that's largely because the nuclear wasn't replaced with the pie in sky wind and solar that they claimed it would be. It was predictably replaced with natural gas. I don't think that those carbon emissions are some sort of moral failure in any way, but I think that the people who advocated for this closure do think that. And so it's kind of an example of the failure of the internal logic of their argument for the closure of this power plant. So I think it's worth pointing out, worth talking about, and worth saying, hey, that thing that you said wasn't going to happen when we closed this plant, it happened.
I know there's a couple of these fights going on. I know the Palisades power plant in Michigan just got approved to be restarted, I think, with some DOE money attached to that. And then in California, I think there's one too.
Diablo Canyon.
Yeah. What, I guess this is a question for Travis. What's the economics of these, like, aging nuclear power plants? Why, other than, you know, obviously they're being targeted by these environmental groups and stuff, but, like, is there reasons for these to be closing down, or what, like, what's going on there?
Well, that's tricky. I mean, in sort of the, in an abstract sense, I would say apply it to the market tests. If you went out in the market, you've earned your spot. The trouble with a lot of this stuff, you know, there's state policies that say it has to be a specific resource. So even the renewable portfolio standards, like, you would expect that a lot of those would be more of like an open-ended clean energy standard. If that's what you wanted, you would go for the stuff that doesn't emit greenhouse gases. A lot of those don't include nuclear. So you're already sort of up against state policy. You're up against things like tax credits at the federal level. So it's not a clear-cut answer. I wish there was a more straightforward way to just apply a market test. But all that said, there is some, you know, there's, when we did this work at IER, was try to estimate the LCOE, put that framework on the existing fleet. And compared to any new build, you know, a fully paid off plant, it's kind of like, you know, the car that you've had forever. You don't have car payments on anymore. You're buying the gasoline and the maintenance. So at that point, there's a lot of power plants that actually pencil out pretty well. And it's a question of how it fits into the given market that it's tied to. So there's a couple, I'll be brief because this is a really complicated answer. The two main frameworks are like, well, if you have an integrated monopoly framework, then it's basically the utility going to the state and saying, here's my plan for how I want to keep the lights on. And then the state has to approve it or not. Those may or may not fare well just based on the way the state views the power plant in question. Nukes probably are viewed more favorably. That's the case in California too, where they kind of change their mind about, we're going to shut down this power plant, or we're going to keep it open. In a more pure market setting where there actually is competition and sort of price-based entry and exit, nukes don't necessarily do well because of the very low-cost resources that are coming online, but not low-cost in an aggregate sense. Low-cost in the sense that the prices are based on marginal costs, and these things have very low marginal costs. Nuke does too, but it also has a very high upfront cost. So long story is, you really, there's no way to tell without a market test, and we don't really have that now. But there is good reason to think that these plants might be worth saving, especially relative to other clean options. They might not be worth saving relative to, say, a new natural gas plant. But if you're in a state that says, we don't want those anymore, of course, I disagree with that policy. But if you're in a state that puts that constraint on yourself, you might as well consider keeping existing nukes open if your other alternatives are like new wind plus new batteries, for example.
Yeah. One of the biggest issues for a lot of the nuclear power plants, especially in RTO areas, has been that wind and solar can sometimes buy in at a negative price, because between the ITC, the investment tax credit, and the PTC, the production tax credit, they're often being paid to produce electricity. And so when it comes time to bid into these auctions, those plants can sometimes bid negative. And if you're the nuclear plant, you can't bid below whatever your costs are, and they're not going to be negative because you're not receiving the same subsidies. And that's true for the gas and coal plants too, but it really forces the economics of the thing and makes it much more difficult for those plants to stay open. And then even if they do pass that test, they end up being sued by Riverkeeper out of existence. Anyway, so it doesn't necessarily even matter if they pass the economic tests.
So the focus of this particular campaign against this particular power plant was the idea that nuclear is, you know, environmentally dangerous and stuff. Paige, can you talk a little bit about that? And then I'm interested to know, like, so with the revelation that obviously this is terrible for their carbon emission targets in New York, like, how are the environmental groups reacting to that news? Have they said anything about it, or
So I have not been seeing a lot of walkbacks from the people that kind of forced the issue on this one. There really has not been a lot of sort of, you know, hat in hand explaining themselves going on. It's been a lot of, I think, mostly trying to ignore that that's happened. But yeah, the issue with nuclear broadly, I think, has been a communications problem. A lot of people fail to realize just how safe and how reliable nuclear technology is. And so as a result, there tends to be a lot of fear mongering around it. And there's a lot of concern, you know, that it's dangerous, that it's dirty, that there's nothing to do with the waste. And so those things, I think, kind of the pathos argument there wins out over the reality of, you know, hundreds of thousands of safe operating hours of plants in the U.S. Besides, I mean, Three Mile Island, which was a much more minor accident than it's often made out to be. But I think that, you know, there's a sort of innate fear of radiation that takes over that any logical arguments surrounding the actual proven safety of the thing. And I think that's kind of natural and human in a lot of ways, but I think it's played on by groups who don't like the technology quite a bit.
Travis, why don't we move to your piece? And I'm going to piggyback on it a little bit because mine was related. You have a new piece on the Cato Institute's blog on the IRA bankrolling recent moves by the EPA. You know, talk about the interaction between Inflation Reduction Act and the new rules coming out of EPA.
Yeah, so it should surprise no one that I don't like it. The interplay between the two is not very well known. So great example is EPA can only, or it's supposed to promulgate rules that, you know, it establishes standards. So under the Clean Air Act for power plants, for example, it can establish the best system of emission reduction. And they're doing that with respect to greenhouse gases. And the way they're characterizing that now is instead of picking something that's adequately demonstrated, statute's very clear on this. It actually uses past tense. It says has been adequately demonstrated. Instead of doing that, what they decided to do was they're going to build the best system. They're going to basically mandate things that are adequately subsidized by the IRA. So if you throw enough federal dollars at something, you can then claim it as sort of the technology of choice that you can then mandate. So my sense is that because the EPA explicitly relied on IRA subsidies to establish the standard, if you can claw back the IRA subsidies, that by definition would also bring down the EPA rule. I have a hunch, though, that the EPA rule is going to go down in flames on its own, just because it has a very similar structure to the Clean Power Plan, which was struck down at the Supreme Court level. And that was sort of what established for the first time in name the major questions doctrine. So that whole process is kind of screwy anyways. But the way the IRA subsidies were used as a foundation of all this stuff, same for the EV rule. The shocking thing to me, and again, I take no pleasure in this, but there's some sweet irony here. Senator Joe Manchin is now complaining about the EPA rules that were built using the Inflation Reduction Act. As you recall, he was instrumental in getting that passed. So he's basically been complaining about his own bill for a year now. And, you know, my hope is that maybe he could be part of the movement, or whoever takes his seat could be part of the movement to claw it back. Knowing now what it is, the only other thing I want to flag about the IRA is not just how it impacts the EPA rules, just the staggering total cost of it. So the original scoring was $369 billion, which was already a lot. That's like a door and face number. That was already a staggering amount. It turns out that was really only a short snapshot. And if you open up the budget window beyond, you know, the 10-year budget window is sort of how the CBO does it. If you open it up, the IRA subsidies have no cap, have no time limit, have no cap on the amount. And I think they're going to reach into the trillions. So if anyone who voted for it was thinking, oh, this is only going to cost taxpayers $370 billion. First of all, how dare you? That's a lot of money. Second of all, it's actually going to be 10 times that. So I'm curious how many people actually voted for it who now, looking back and knowing how much it's going to cost, would change their mind about that vote.
It's interesting, too. So the EPA rules, the legal challenges to them, obviously going to take some time. So even if that does sink them, isn't the thinking, I don't know, from what I've heard, you know, that they put the rules in place knowing that they're not going to stand up. But by the time that everything's said and done, they had to already adapt to what they had planned, right? So
yeah, and we don't have to speculate about that, because there's part of me that thinks, well, let's not talk about people's motives. We know for sure what Gina McCarthy's motives were in doing the Matz rule in, you know, 2012 and the Clean Power Plan in 2015. She was very clear. She went on a TV show. She went on Bill Maher's show and said, well, we think we're going to win in court, but even if we don't, people have already complied. So basically it's water under the bridge. We got what we wanted, even if we find out later that it was not legally sound from the beginning. So some of it, I think there is that mentality of like, well, we're just going to get what we want anyways. And by the time you win in court, it's too late for you. That is certainly true when it comes to the idea that you want to know what the rules are. If you want to be sure that you're in compliance 5 years from now, and the thing that you're building has a life that's, you know, an asset life that's well over 5 years, like a power plant would, you're going to build the thing that's probably going to comply with the rule that you're not sure maybe is going to be there, maybe not. So in order to play it safe in this era of, you know, uncertainty on what the rules are, you just go ahead and comply voluntarily, even if the thing isn't binding, or it turns out later that it wasn't binding. So it's a really dirty tactic and I hate it, but it's not a secret. They say this stuff out loud in public. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, the piece that I sent you guys was sort of a follow-on, focusing on the heavy truck rule. The light-duty vehicle rule kind of got more of the headlines, but last Friday, EPA released that. And I was interested in it because, obviously, trucking and shipping, you know, plays a big role in our supply chains and stuff. And I was digging in to see, like, okay, you know, has anyone tried electrifying their trucking fleet? Like, to what extent are we doing this already? And, you know, they're aiming for like 25% of long haul trucks by 2030, I believe, to be, you know, either electric or probably like a hydrogen fuel cell, right? And I looked into it. So Pepsi is the biggest company that I've seen try to do this. They made a bunch of headlines last year. They were one of the first companies to buy Tesla's trucks, and they implemented it in California with the state paying for most of the trucks, which are, you know, two or three times the cost of a diesel truck. But the way that they've implemented them has basically been the most efficient use of them have been limited to routes about 100 miles, and they're only running about 12 hours a day. And then if you dig into, you know, how long freight routes actually last in this country and stuff, you know, long haul freight routes are usually on average like 500 miles. So if we're talking about converting all of or a large portion of these trucks to electric, the implications for supply chains and the cost of shipping things, the cost of goods all over the country is going to be pretty profound. So that was just something that I wanted to raise, because I felt like the heavy truck rule probably wasn't getting as many headlines because, of course, it was released on Good Friday, and the light duty stuff kind of grabbed more of the attention.
I should know this better than I do, but when we
say heavy trucks, what is the bar above which we're talking for heavy? Does that include things like the UPS delivery truck or a garbage truck, or is this strictly 18-wheelers?
Yeah, so the EPA is like, regulatory impact assessment for like urban delivery trucks, they're aiming for like 60% of those. And then the long haul, like big semi-truck, like tractor trailers, is like 25% by 2032.
Well, it certainly makes more sense in the
urban context for a couple of reasons. One, regenerative braking. Two, local air pollution. But yes, on the long hauls, the technology is not suitable.
Yes, I'm thinking about doing a piece about supply chains and this stuff. I need to dig into it more, but it just seems like right now the technology doesn't seem to be there, as it's already been implemented. And I don't know, 5 years comes up pretty fast. So,
isn't that the explicit weakness of EVs, is that they're not good for long trips? Everybody knows this. We all talk about this. So the idea that you would try to convert a business that is predicated on long hauls, like it's so backwards and so absurd. I think there's a reason that none of this was happening on its own. I've heard about companies that have been trying to do this for a long time. Some have been embroiled in scandals and things like that. But there's a reason that this is not happening on its own. And the fact that sort of the EPA standards are being sold to us now as, oh, we're just tightening standards and we're moving in the direction of cleaner and you're still going to have choice, et cetera, et cetera. One thing I wanted to flag about this is I'm seeing a shift in language. And this is the worry that I have about the progressive playbook as I see it, is that they propose a policy, it's wildly unpopular, and they say, well, we're going to key on the word that people find unpopular and decide to stop using that word, instead of zooming out and saying, maybe the policy itself is unpopular. So maybe mandating EVs is an unpopular thing. Like, that's not what we're about in this country. We don't want to tell anybody what to drive. So instead you say, oh, well, we're not going to change the policy. We're just going to not use the word ban anymore because people don't like bans, even though that's exactly the impact of the policy. So I just want to call that out too, because I'm seeing too much of this, of like, their bad policies are slamming right into the brick wall of public disfavor. And instead of saying, oh, wow, our policies suck, we need to change them, they are terrible, people hate them, they're saying, oh, people really dislike this one word that we use, so we're going to stop using that word. And it's become this weird war of language instead of actual fundamental policy change.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to see the sort of like PR machine go to work then too, where, I mean, there were at least 10 articles emphasizing this is not a ban. New York Times, you know, Politico, everywhere. And yeah, it's a war about language instead of rethinking, like, maybe this stuff just is not popular and isn't going to work.
On this idea of not using the word ban, Travis, do you think that
is a genuine reframing to try to communicate to people what's occurring? Or do you think it is a deceit?
So the answer depends on which policy you're talking about. So when it comes to the EPA standard, it's technically correct that it's not an outright ban. It's a standard. It's kind of like what they're doing on the power plant side, which is, again, I don't see the real distinction here. But what they're saying is all we're doing is mandating that fossil fuel power plants adopt either green hydrogen or carbon capture or both. But if you know that the practical reality is that neither of those are feasible, then what you're doing is you're like mandating impossible thing one, impossible thing two, or you can shut down. In practical terms, that means you're going to shut down. So you could call it a power plant shutdown rule. They would say, well, you're being overly aggressive with the language. We know in practice that is the fundamental reality. So there's that splitting hairs on the EPA stuff. When it comes to the state policy, like the Clean Cars 2 program, that is an outright ban. That is saying, for all of the states that have adopted the California approach, you can't have internal combustion engines sold in that state past, I don't know, 2030. So I don't know what to call that other than a ban. That is explicitly a ban. And when I've confronted people who say, this is not a ban, like, well, maybe we can split hairs on the EPA side. You cannot split hairs on the state policy side. And they go silent at that point. So I think it depends which one you're talking about. EPA side, maybe. There's an argument that that there's some gray area with the language. On the state level, internal combustion engine bans, there's no gray area. And I completely disagree with the idea that we should stop using the word ban, because that's exactly what they're. So one interesting thing to note about these mandates and bans and things like that, like, we wouldn't need a ban on the internal combustion engine if we came up with something better. I think it's just the reality. I don't know if it's an uncomfortable one or what. I actually like a gas-powered car. But if we wanted something better, the way to beat it is not to ban the thing that exists that we know works. Just come up with something better and it'll win out. It's like the horse and buggy analogy. Like, nobody really had to go out and ban those. We just came up with something better. So the idea that now the way to force the transition is to come up with either tighter regs or outright bans, this idea, it's like, it's almost the policy itself has to create the need and then you innovate. Like, we're getting this backwards. Like, the innovation should come organically, and then the new outcome, the transition itself, will be painless. This idea that we need to force a transition, we need to basically destroy everything that works and try to come up with, hope that we come up with something that can replace it, that just seems completely backwards to me. And that's, it's this weird, the mentality is basically that the transition has to come from the top down, has to be forced and mandated. And that's just a really dangerous way of approaching it.
Yeah, I mean, kind of circling back to what I was saying about the shift in thinking in the US, it's interesting to me how like notable entrepreneurs now have very distinct visions of products that they want to put out in the world. And then the process always seems, well, not always, but often seems to be that, okay, well, then how do I go to the government to make this be the thing, right? And that's very concerning, because obviously there's an element to entrepreneurship where you like you see something out there in the world that other people haven't recognized or realized yet, and you're trying to create and engineer the world to for that thing to come into existence. But it's a very interesting shift in sort of cultural attitudes where now it's being done through politics instead of through like, no, this is going to make your life better.
Yeah. And the thing that makes it make sense for me is if you take the Bastiat approach, view the world through the lens of the consumer, it's that makes everything make a lot more sense, because it's not like, well, which business should I support? How do you ever know which producer you should support, or you pick winners and losers? The winner should always be the consumer. And so the idea that you should take away choices or ban things is just, it flies in the face of a consumer focused view, which I don't see too many people take that view. And that's troubling too, or it's basically like, especially in our space, in our policy world, it's always like, I get this question all the time. It's like, well, what energy source do you like? What's your favorite? Do you have a fuel of choice? And like, I have the fuel of like, my favorite thing is the thing that people actually go out and buy and love and pay for on their own voluntarily. That's the thing that I like. It really hardly anybody takes that view where it's like, oh, well, I have a, you know, I have a crush on coal, gas, or oil, or however you want to approach it. There's, of course, a whole lot of folks that have the opposite view. Like, it has to be nukes, only nukes. That's the only thing that we'll talk about. Wind, solar, batteries, et cetera. Of course, there's a guy at Stanford who wants everything wind, water, solar. He's had those blinders on for decades. And unfortunately, I think we get into this fuel war, and it reminds me of sort of the partisanship where it's like, you know, red team, blue team type stuff. Like, we're actually the same team. We're all consumers. You know, we should be more open to that kind of thinking, instead of it always gets back to fuel wars, and it's always so frustrating.
At a certain point, it's about what's reliable and what works and what becomes affordable as it's more reliable and works better. And it's more about focusing on those, I think, attributes, and on allowing people to freely pay for those attributes as they prefer to, than it is about sort of ends-based thinking that says, I think that it should be this type of grid, or I think it should be this type of fuel for vehicles, and so that's what I'm going to have. I think that, you know, we need to be much more focused on what it does than what it is.
Yep, Jordan. So why don't we wrap up with your piece, sent over an article from the New York Times, Can We Engineer Our Way Out of the Climate Crisis? And I thought this was interesting. So talk about the article, and then I don't know, what was it that brought this to your attention?
The New York Times coverage goes on some recent carbon capture build out in Iceland. And I got to admit, I occasionally get seduced by these grand utopian schemes. And this is one of them. I love the idea of geoengineering as the best way to manage changes that will result from global warming. And then I'm reminded of unintended consequences. And that's something that you've always impressed upon me, Alex, is that as much as smart people might be able to explain the benefits of something, they often can't really think through what some of the downsides might be. And I'm afraid this is a bit of a blind spot for me. I think about us developing technology, getting wealthier, and then resolving this challenge via things like carbon capture or ocean fertilization. And I don't have the imagination to think of all the bad that could come from that. I think that's something I need to be more cognizant of, that these ideas may bring about as much trouble as they solve.
Yeah, there's definitely potential for that, I think. But I mean, at the same time too, like, I don't know, like carbon capture is obviously like cost prohibitive right now, but it's interesting to me that there isn't more people saying like, okay, this is something that could potentially solve this problem. Let's do this through a nonprofit or something, right? Like, so often we talk about things in terms of like, does this make, you know, commercial sense? Like, at the end of the day, is like, are you gonna make money off this? And like, obviously that's what drives most of the world, and that's very important. But I think, you know, one of the things that we don't emphasize enough from our sort of classical liberal free market perspective too, is that we have all these other sorts of institutions and ways to raise money to do things that aren't necessarily, you know, commercially viable. So I don't know, to me, like, I think yeah, those projects are interesting, but
there,
like,
there are yeah. some
market driven and you might say civil society driven projects out there. There's a company that does internet payment processing called Stripe, and Stripe has set up, it's now been a few years since they've done it, they've set up a option on their website where vendors who utilize them can allocate some of their revenue to these sorts of geoengineering projects, or really research at this stage to come up with good ideas. So that's a basically pure charity approach. There's another company out there called Frontier that has a lot of venture funding, and they're basically providing guaranteed money to startups that are coming up with creative ways to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. What I wanted to highlight, though, is how these ideas, as attractive as they are to me, they probably have downsides that will come with them as well, that are just as politically contentious as any benefit they could deliver.
Yep. I mean, I think that's definitely something that, I don't know, I think anything that you're going to do in the world, there's going to be somebody who's going to raise a concern about something. It gets back to, you know, giving people freedom and flexibility and the ability to try new things, and understanding that, like, yes, there could potentially be problems with this stuff, but in order to make progress, like, you do have to test out new things in the world and try to do new stuff. So a cultural attitude that sort of embraces that mindset, I think in the long run, even if there are downsides, in the long run, we end up in a better place. So before we go, I want to give you guys a chance just to talk about what you guys are working on. Paige, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I have a few recent op-eds on the DOE Transformer Steel Rule that I think I would like for people to check out. That's all for me.
Jordan?
Just prior to hopping on with the three of
you, I was finishing up text on an op-ed that should run in a publication called Nikkei Asia. It's one of the leading English language publications discussing economics, technology, and business in Asia. And this piece is going to be about Taiwan's energy politics. I have a side gig with the Global Taiwan Institute, so I pay close attention to Taiwan energy. They had an election in Taiwan in January, and the incumbent's party won the presidency, but no longer has a hold on the legislature. So there's an interesting opportunity, I think, for a compromise on energy, particularly around extending the lifespan of nuclear power plants in Taiwan. Taiwan, super important global economy for its production, most notably of semiconductors, and they're facing some significant constraints on electricity generation because they're prematurely retiring their nuclear reactors. They need to change course, and I think this election provides them that chance.
It always has the global perspective of things. Travis, what do you have on deck for us?
So my longer term project, and I've been working on this for a while, but it feels like a moving target. IRA repeal, making the case for, at the very least, repealing the production tax credit that kicks in next year. And this is the tax credit that, you know, if sort of left unchecked, would be, you know, I've estimated something like $3 trillion worth by 2050. And it's the thing that only phases down if the grid reaches some absurdly low level of greenhouse gas emissions. It's the 25% level of 2022 as a baseline, which, as we talked about with demand growing, the odds that will ever happen, I think, are pretty close to zero. We'll see. I'd be happy to be wrong about that. But the fact that it's uncapped, the fact that it's going to be so expensive, the looming fiscal crisis, all of this is setting up for a very interesting 2025. And the goal for me is to put together a policy report that makes a strong enough case for IRA repeal that we actually claw back, ideally repeal the whole thing, you know, in a compromise sense, at least claw it back, put some kind of cap on the spending, because as it was written in past, and this is not the way to do climate policy, by the way, this is the president's signature climate policy. It's a budget reconciliation measure that just puts the production tax credit on steroids. I'm oversimplifying everything, but you can't have a signature climate policy that was passed as a budget measure. And the doing it that way meant that there weren't enough eyeballs on it. There wasn't enough debate. A bunch of bad stuff is in there. So we need to get back in there and clean it up. So that's my top priority.
Keep an eye out for that. I just want to put a few things on our listeners' radar. So IR is releasing our 2024 North American Energy Inventory. It's an update of a report that we did, I think, back in 2011, which provides an overview of all of North America's oil, gas, and coal resources. I'm going to be doing some radio next week on that. And then on Thursday, I'm appearing on the Financial Sense NewsHour podcast. I don't think they gave me a topic, but it's probably going to be oil prices and probably the new EPA rules. And then next up on the podcast, we have Dr. Pierre Desrochers from the University of Toronto. We're going to be discussing his book on population and the environment. And thank you guys for joining me today. Was interesting, as always, to chat energy policy with you guys, and appreciate your time. Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe. And to learn more about our work here at IER, please visit theinstituteforenergyresearch.org.